I'm going to now begin. It's 1:20, and I don't want to eat into any opportunities to have the audience ask questions. I am Aparna Mehrotra, the focal point for women at the UN, and it is my great pleasure, in full solidarity, to wish you a happy Women's Day. It's a day that we use to celebrate all that we do. We also remember all the struggles that we have, and we also use this day to partner with somebody, because no struggle and no accomplishment can occur on its own. So please look at the person on your right and shake their hand. I'm on the left. Now we aren't done with this. Please look at the person on your left and shake their hand. Okay. I also want to welcome here in particular, before I do all the protocolarian welcomes, the men in the room, because this is a panel on the issue of flexibility and productivity. I am very pleased to see that over time we are making progress in sending the message that this is not an issue of any given gender. This is an issue of humanity, and humanity in the workplace in particular. So I'm very pleased, and I extend a special welcome to all the men who are here and are giving of their time, because time is probably, in today's day and age, the most valuable resource that we have to manage on an hourly basis. I mean, we manage other valuable resources, but on an hourly basis, I think time is what never leaves us. So with that, I will begin our panel, and I will briefly say a few words. I will then introduce the speakers. The format of this panel, from what I, based on feedback I receive, is not one of speeches. I think the UN is speeched out. And therefore, I have taken the liberty of asking people around the UN what questions they're interested in. And based on that, we have come up with 6 questions. Hopefully, they will cover the field and will provide some answers and some enlightenment. I will also be very clear that I am not hosting this panel without an objective. The objective for this panel is to bring allies to the table. All of you are allies. The objective of this panel is to enlighten you with small weapons, which is called information in a nonviolent context. And the other objective is to have you then go out and do 2 things. Number one, you have to go out and demand the use of these flexible work arrangements, because you are often up against a culture that doesn't necessarily allow it. But our courage must go with our conviction. So I would require that, please, anyone who feels they can benefit from it, put it on record, make the request, even if it is denied, and then count the denials and why they're denied, assess whether it's fair or not, and when it's not fair, please raise the issue. We are here to listen to you, and we're here to work with anybody and everybody to facilitate your lives. We cannot facilitate productivity without facilitating lives. So this is what this is about. And the second objective is, of course, that we would like engagement which is not just personal. We would like you to believe in this issue. We would like you to advocate for this issue. And we would like you to make a difference in the life of another who you help. Take it on as a cause that is larger than yourself. So let me not be a hypocrite about why I'm having this panel. It's not just to assist the organization. It is to assist each one of us. It is to make our lives better, and it is to make the lives of everybody whose life we touch better. So there is an agenda, and this is it. Now, I would like to begin by thanking the Secretary General. I have worked in 25 years of my career under the cultures brought by many Secretary Generals, as have most of you, and I would like to say that I feel particularly moved by Secretary General Ban's commitment to this issue of gender. Never before have we had 6 deputy special representatives. We now have 1 special representative, and I do believe that he has put out many communications, including the one on April 19th of last year, where he has specifically signed his name to the need for the organization to enter modernity, those are my words, but to enter a culture of efficiency, which, amongst other things, requires flexibility, flexible minds, flexible management, and flexible work-life fit. We will hear about that later. So I thank him. I also thank the Deputy Secretary General, with whom we unfortunately have to compete because she's sitting next door running her own event, and that was a very big disappointment. But I have to say that she has been the first Deputy Secretary General to have chaired a session 2 weeks ago specifically on the issue of work life within the organization. So I would like to give her credit in her absence. I would like to thank the Department of Management, who I don't know has sent anybody. Is anyone here from the Department of Management? Thank you for being here, because that is very encouraging. I would like to thank the Department of Management because they have in particular championed telecommuting. They have put out a survey to 16,000 staff. Of that, we have received responses from 3,700 staff, and that is a very good response rate for the United Nations in a moment of crisis. People are extremely busy, and we nonetheless, that's a very good response, and the response rate says a lot about what people are feeling about this. When the survey results are out, the survey is closed at the end of January. We haven't finished any sort of analysis, but when they're out, I'm sure that at least our office, as well as the Department of Management, will be sharing it with you. I would also like to thank the Department of Human Resources, without whom no agenda we all know can move forward. Is anyone here from the Department of Human Resources or the office? Huh? It is part of DM, but is anyone here from OHRM? Oh, good. Thank you. Welcome to you. We have worked with you, and we appreciate it. I would just like to say here that, you know, oftentimes when you go to the law, they say if you have the facts, you advocate with the facts and win the case based on the facts. If you know, then if that doesn't work, you look at the legislation. And if that doesn't work, then you go and you look at the intent of the founders of the legislation or the intent behind Congress, and then if that doesn't work, you look at the intent of the founders who wrote the Constitution. And I think in this case, I would like to say that our facts, our legislation, our spirit, whether it's in our policies or in our founding documents, all support the issue of flexibility. And because of this, we have promulgated policies in 2003 on this matter. The issue now is implementation, as you might have suspected from my opening remark. I was asked very specifically by focal points. We have a network of 60 focal points and alternates without whom I cannot do anything. And I would like to appreciate them today on this special day for what they do in their departments. They have a very difficult job to do, and I would like to thank them specially, and I would like to pay them my respects by doing what they asked me to do. They said to me that people were not aware that the flexible working arrangements existed. I am hereby making you aware there are 4 kinds of arrangements, and you will have policies at the back which will give you the circular in case you need it when you request it. We also have the issue of flexi time reflected in the compacts with the Undersecretary Generals that the Secretary General makes. We also have it in the Human Resource Action Plans, which as of this year are all public. It's transparent. It is available on the intranet. And we have the mention of this arrangement in the draft gender strategy, which you will all witness as a document eventually this year, in the scorecard of the organization on reporting how matters are, and in the terms of reference of the focal points themselves, who, in the words of the of the Secretary General's bulletin are required to encourage the use of these arrangements. So there is a lot of policy out there, and I was asked to tell you about it because apparently there is an insufficient amount of awareness. As far as statistics are concerned, so you know, we are making progress, but in 2004, we had approximately 25,000 staff use flexible work arrangements. In 2008, when I wrote the report, we only were showing 1,500. We are very cognizant of the fact that something is going on. There is a culture that is not necessarily facilitating the use of these. It is an option, but from what I hear in the corridors, more people want to use the option. The other myth that we would like to debunk is that this is women using it. Our statistics show that in the professional levels, the usage of this is 50-50 for women and men, and at the director level, it is actually 65% used by men. So it's very interesting to see that as the power shifts, they are using it when they have authority to do so. So it is an important statistic to keep in mind. And I think as my final point, I would like to say, because I deeply believe that the power of the guilt-gratitude nexus, which is not a power that is quantified in times where everything needs to be quantified, but the true motivators of productivity are not quantitative. They are conviction and they are qualitative. And the guilt-gratitude nexus propels people to work better and to work longer and to work with less fear and to work with greater capacity and greater conviction and greater quality. And that is the guilt-gratitude nexus on which I think often flexible work time runs. It is a motor. It is effective. It is the BMW or the Mercedes of this issue. And I think unless we embrace it, we cannot expect to enter this century with the bang that it needs. I mean, the world is a mess, and we need to do everything we can to fix it, and productivity is very much part of it. I've taken far more time than I was allocated, but in my view, these are messages that you must know and that you must carry with you in order to be an ally. An ally is a person who gives voice to the voiceless. So welcome as allies. Now, I will next introduce all of the wonderful, wonderful panelists we have here. I would also like to say to you that the fact that the panelists are here is a tribute to the United Nations, in case we are skeptical about it, and is also a tribute to modernity. I have found each one of these persons purely on the web. I also know that each one of these persons have probably accepted at short notice because this is the United Nations. So I would like to welcome them warmly and deeply and genuinely. On my right, we have Ms. Deborah Epstein Henry. She is the founder and president of FlexiTime Lawyers, a national consulting firm advising law firms, corporations, and lawyers on work-life balance and the retention and promotion of women. All these biographies are available to you at the back. In a partnership with the New York Bar Association, she has released as the principal author a book called The Cheat Sheet, which is the ultimate guide to selecting, creating, and ensuring a work-friendly employer. Now, Ms. Henry is a senior fellow and legal industry advisor to the Hidden Brain Drain Task Force for the Center for Work Life. She is also the mother of three boys. On my left is Mr. Brad Harrington, who is the executive director of the Boston College Center for Work and Family and a professor of organizational behavior in the Carroll School of Management. in his faculty role, Dr. Harrington's teaching and research in the School of Management focuses on career planning and work-life integration, human resources management, contemporary workforce management strategies, and the leadership of organizational cultural change. He is the parent of two daughters and one son. We next have Ms. Barbara Taylor. She is from BDO Seidman, and she provides assurance, tax, financial advisory, and consultancy services to a wide range of publicly traded and privately held companies. Ms. Taylor is the principal general counsel of BDO Seidman, and she is responsible for the retention and supervision of outside counsel in addition to being responsible for legal and liability insurance matters for the firm. As a senior counsel of Ernst & Young, where she also was, Ms. Taylor has had direct responsibility for all phases of federal and state court litigation, including pleadings, discovery, motion practice, and settlement negotiations. And then to my extreme left, we have Ms. Kali Yost, and I cannot not say a special word of thanks to Kali. I never met Kali. I heard her on the radio, which is why I contacted her. And I really believe that I don't believe this. I know that I was very deeply moved by the collaboration that she offered us over and above anything that I either requested or that I could have expected. She put herself in the middle of this all voluntarily, helping to coordinate, contacting people, and I really appreciate what she has done, both in her actions and in her spirit, and I have to give her a special welcome and a special thank you with all due respect to all others. She has her clients in her work include many Fortune 500 companies, and in addition, she is the author of Work Life, Finding the Fit That Is Right for You. She has some very innovative ideas, like do all others, which I'm sure you will be happy to hear. She's also very modernist and has created the first blog focusing on the complex issue of managing work life and business in today's 24/7 culture. I welcome everybody, and I will now open the questions for all the panelists. We have six questions. And hopefully we will have time to take questions from the floor. In principle, each panelist has 3 minutes to answer a given question. Perhaps it can sometimes be shorter. The first question is, why is flexibility an important business strategy for organizations to be productive and profitable today? What is particular about today that makes it particularly important, more so than last year, perhaps? And if there is any stigma associated with this, how have they, in their work and experience, known of cases of overcoming the stigma? So
I'll take the first half of that question, if it's okay, on really why is flexibility an important business strategy. I think there are a number of converging factors at play right now that are really changing the flexibility picture. So it's not that small group of stigmatized moms who wanted to avail themselves of flexible policies, but now it's a much broader issue. So what's really at play and what's changing the dialogue is, one, increased work demands. I'm sure all of you can attest to the fact that the expectation of work output and delivery is so much greater than it was for you even 1 or 2 years or certainly 5 years ago. The second is, it's not just that the demands at work are overwhelming and more than they were before. It's also the demands at home and in your community. The expectation of involvement, whether it's your kids' lives, in your church or synagogues, in the nonprofit work you do, those demands outside of work have really grown. And the third is really technology and the globalization of work and how we're all competing in global time zones and really across the map. And before, it was much more local work that we were doing, or national at best. That globalization, that change, mostly because of technology and how we're working, is really bringing flexibility to the fore. And the last factor that I think is really changing the dialogue is generational shifts. There's so much emphasis on Gen Y and how they're demanding to do work differently, but it's not just Gen Y. That's a huge pressure point. At 80 million, they're the largest employee and consumer group ever, Gen Y. But the other complement to generational shifts that's really changing the picture and really forcing flexibility are baby boomers. They are changing the way retirement happens. It's impacting succession planning. They want to phase into retirement over 5 to 10 years rather than their predecessors who just retired one day. So there, and also with their 401k is split in half, they also are changing the way they're working. So those four converging factors are really changing things and really forcing all of us to look at flexibility. It's the only way that we can really compete now and in the future, and it is so closely tied to productivity. And I'll just give you one example of that before I turn it over to some other panelists. There was a great study done in 2005 by a nonprofit organization called the Bold Initiative, where they piloted 10 different companies, and they gave them all different flexibility options like telecommuting and compressed work weeks and reduced hours and all different types of flexibility. And these were large companies, Chubb Insurance, Prudential Financial, Gannett Newspapers, large companies. And what they did over this pilot is they assessed that through all those flexibility offerings, each of these 10 employers increased their productivity by 5 to 10%. That's a really, really tangible example of how productivity is so closely aligned with flexibility, and there are countless others that my panelists can share. Thank you.
Aparna, thank you for having me here today. It's wonderful to be here. What I find is to build on what Debbie said is organizations are seeing flexibility no longer just as a policy or a program. It really is a way of operating. It is a business strategy. And if you can see, I find this slide very helpful when I give speeches and when I go into clients, because I think sometimes what we tend to do is focus on the individual trees, so we miss the forest. We don't see all of the business applications of the very same flexibility in how, when, and where work is done. So, for example, at the UN, you have your 50-50 parity goals, which are very important. And yes, women need the flexibility to manage all the transitions they'll experience in their life and their work throughout their career. But as I'm sure Barbara can tell you in a minute, in her company, they found out, actually, that the men needed it more than the women. So to a degree, again, folk, the women, very important, but it's really everybody that needs the flexibility. The next business case that is here at the UN is the fact that you all have to leave this building, and it's being renovated, so you have to find space for everybody. And this is really an issue for a lot of organizations. Organizations are, whether they're in high-rent cities or they just don't want to have the overhead cost of real estate space, are realizing they can use flexibility to save on those costs. The next piece, as Debbie said, is global client coverage. You are all on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, covering the globe. And that's the way it's playing out in a lot of organizations today. And they're understanding that they, in order to allow their employees to be productive and not burn out, they need to be flexible to allow for that coverage to happen in a way that works for both the employee and the organization. Then, of course, there are the demographic changes, as Debbie mentioned. And in your organization, you have a large percentage of your employee base that is probably going to retire in the next few years. And again, how do you keep that talent? How might you keep them connected to the organization, but give them the flexibility they want for some other parts of their life? And then also, how do you attract in then the next generation of employees for whom flexibility is just how they work? It's just what they do, right? So, again, it solves both of those problems, just two separate business impacts. And finally, but actually not least in any way, I know this is a subject near and dear to your Secretary General's heart, and that is really environmental sustainability. A lot of organizations are seeing, again, that very same flexibility as a way to, you know, save on some energy, have some people not commute perhaps, and, again,
all goes to those different impacts, same flexibility strategy, very broad implementation for very broad impact for an organization. And that is what's getting companies to see this as much more than a policy and a program, really a way they need to operate. And I think Barbara can probably illustrate from with her in her company how their flexibility strategy played out.
Thank you, Callie. Can I get the third slide? Perfect. Thank you. As Callie mentioned, the work that we did at BDOC even actually did originate within our women's initiative, for which I was the chairperson. We decided before we launched anything big on flexibility, though, to do some additional assessment. And it was during that assessment work that we discovered that our men were actually struggling more with work-life issues than our women, and our people without children were struggling more with work-life issues than our people with children. Based on that, we knew it was important to separate our work on flexibility from work on the Women's Initiative, and I volunteered to chair the task force because of the large role that flexibility has played in the success of my career to date. We underwent an in-depth assessment process and strategy development process and ultimately devised the business strategy that you see on the screen. Well, this was originally created in a time where there was tremendous demand for our services and fewer people to supply those services. It is working extremely well as we enter into a down cycle within the economy. As you can see, we've got a number of different business-related components. Yes, we believe that through our vision, the best people will want to work at BDO Seidman, but we also know that flexibility will help them deliver quality service from a knowledgeable staff, which is a great way to hold on to clients. It helps us do a great job of planning engagements and managing our resources, which boosts productivity and profitability. It gives our people gratifying careers and a fit that works for them, which is another retention tool. And then lastly, from a cultural shift, this was a real change for us. Our daily conversations and our attitudes reflected open communication and innovative problem solving in a way that we had not seen before. And we're actually seeing that culture shift impact other things that we're doing as a business.
Okay.
Brad says he's okay. So we'll go
on. I don't know what the rest of people think, but I think I'm okay. So.
Okay. So we think he's more than okay. So now we will move to the next question. Just as a comment, I think that the in the UN, the Secretary General has been pushing greatly because the environmental climate change is his first agenda. He has two priorities, stated priorities, and one is food crisis and the other is the environmental climate change issue. And there are clear savings to be had there. And there is a company in India called Infosys, which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange, which is located in Bangalore. And in Bangalore, it takes 3 hours for just about anybody to get to work. And they found that they were losing a lot of people who got fed up of commuting. They were losing the women, and they were also getting, you know, less work out of the men because they were sitting in their cars. So Infosys instituted a policy saying that in order to avoid traffic jams and traffic, they would just give anybody who wanted flexibility to work from wherever they wanted. And I believe that their retentions went up, as did the motivation, as did their productivity. And that's an entire company. I think it's number one or number two globally in their area of work. So it's not an impractical issue. It's working and it's proven. And that's the message that I think the UN has to embrace. The resist for those who are understanding of the benefits and the power of this method, it's very difficult to understand why the resistance is there, but it's there, and one has to find ways to work with it in an eloquent and non-confrontational manner. But these type of statistics are helpful, as is everything that people today will tell you that you should then use to convince others. The second question is, have you noticed any particular managerial effective styles that have allowed leaders to transform a culture of rigidity into a culture of flexibility? Brad?
Well, I think, we work with our center at Boston College works with about 100 major employers. And just real quickly, just a sample, is we work with companies like Dow, Johnson & Johnson, IBM, Pricewaterhouse, Marriott, Sodexo, UPS, BP, Chevron. So you're talking about very large employers and across an enormous spectrum of industries. So one of the things I would say, first of all, is if you have a tendency to think, well, flexibility may work in some specific kinds of organizations, but it won't work here, I could say that we have ample evidence that flexibility can work virtually anywhere. And I always used to say maybe with the exception of law firms, but I now know that that's not true because law firms just seem to be stuck in this paradigm that there was only one way to succeed in a law firm. I think the fact that we have 100 organizations as members is a testament to the fact that these organizations, who are so well-respected, so big, so complex, see this issue as really a kind of a bottom-line thing that they need to take hold of. And primarily the driver is talent management. How do we keep the best people? Initially that was women they were particularly concerned about. But as I think Barbara mentioned, men have as many struggles with this as women do these days. The second thing is, I think the issue of leaders being committed to corporate social responsibility. You just mentioned that in terms of environmental movement. But I think, really, if you think of corporate social responsibility and its relationship to work life, there's three angles why leaders might be interested. One is, when you measure corporate social responsibility or corporate citizenship, the number one factor that people take into consideration is, how does the organization treat its people? Okay, so if you want to be held up as a socially responsible company, how you treat your employees is the number one indicator of whether you will be seen as such or not. Number two is, by having work-life and flexibility programs, I think these organizations offer employees the opportunity to spend time with their family and do things in the community, the kinds of things you mentioned, which really strengthen society as a whole. And then finally, this whole idea of, you know, being more green. A lot of flexibility programs can do things to reduce carbon footprint, reduce commuting time, reduce, inefficient meetings and so forth. So all of those things, I think, play into why leaders should support it. Just one last comment about leaders. I think the important thing is that leaders be congruent between what they believe and what they then talk about in terms of the kinds of actions they're willing to embark on when it comes to flexibility. In a few minutes, we'll talk about all the different forms flexibility takes, but I think one of the things that's very important is that a leader has to convey with conviction and consistently what they believe about flexibility and what they're willing to allow within their organization. And I say that is particularly important in this case for one reason. I think there are a lot of people who take their signals about what's appropriate to do within an organization or what's the right way to behave in an organization by looking at what leaders do. And unfortunately, most people who enter into or get into senior management positions in organizations of any type tend to be workaholics. They tend to be dominated by their career identity. They tend to work enormously long hours. And it would seem, if you look at their lives, that these are people who don't have work-life balance at all. So if leaders are really going to be effective in terms of engendering work-life balance or work-life integration within their organization, one of the things they have to do is be clear on what they're going to really support, and the second thing they have to do is be authentic about the fact that they may have made choices that are different than the choices they expect from others, and the fact that they personally may work 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, is a choice that they've made, but that they want to convey clearly and consistently to the people who work in the organization that they don't expect those exact same choices from them. The reason they're in senior leadership is because they've been willing to make those sacrifices around work life, but they have to be able to convey to their employees in an authentic way that that does not mean that everybody has to make those kinds of choices. And unless they do that, then people will look at them as role models and say, my boss's boss works enormously long hours, weekends, always on their laptop, always on their BlackBerry, therefore that must be the expectation that I'll do the same. So.
I'll say one thing about that, and I'm going to pass it over to Barbara because I think she's got an excellent example. Barbara, Vigo Siemens, my client, so if you're seeing why I keep saying to Barbara, I just know they've done some good things. One of the
things that we did or what we do in BDO and in the other clients I work with, we don't use the word work-life balance. And that tends to get over some of the stigma that is attached to the work-life decisions that people make. I use the word work-life fit in my business because I think what it does is it just says everybody's unique. Everybody has their own work and personal realities. Everybody's going to be different at a different place in time. To Brad's point, certain people made different decisions. Nobody's right. Nobody's wrong. But we just need the flexibility to let all those work-life fit realities live together in the organization. So that's one of the ways I think we got over in BDO Seed, and some of the resistance we got from the word balance just was a tough word for some of the senior leadership, and it just helped open up the conversation.
At my firm, we got fully engaged leadership in a variety of ways. First and foremost, at the beginning of the process, we engaged them both in the creation of the vision and in the development and then implementation of the strategy. So there was opportunities for input all along the way, starting with our chief executive officer, encompassing also our board of directors, and then our entire regional leadership structure. As we went through the process, they also began to learn, primarily because of the way we were looking at this, which is really a spectrum of different work-life fits with flexible, formal flexible work arrangements at one end and taking 2 hours at lunch to go to the dentist at the other end, that the entire senior leadership team was working flexibly in some respect. And I think once that dawned on them, they were far more engaged than they were before when they realized this is something that is actually benefiting me. In addition, because this is a business strategy for us, this is also a tool for business success for our leaders, and they began to see it as such and embrace it as such. And because of that, that created the kind of engagement that perhaps we wouldn't have seen if it stayed more just as a pure employee retention tool. This is really a way to help our business leaders be more successful than they might be otherwise.
Yeah, Aparna, I had asked the question earlier about stigma, and we've kind of danced around it, but I wanted to address it head on because it's very apropos to this leadership issue and what kind of tone is set. Stigma is a real issue with this, and the usage rates that Aparna mentioned before at the UN are very reflective of that stigma, that people want the flexibility, everybody wants the flexibility, but everyone's afraid to avail themselves of it. So I want to just get some nuts and bolts ideas out there about how to really implement flexibility without stigma to really change the picture, because historically, these individuals who avail themselves of the policies, they don't get the good work. They're suddenly not on the promotion track. They're not getting the good office. They're not being paid commensurate with what their delivery of work is. And suddenly the picture really changes. So how do we change that around, assuming, as Brad outlined, we have that ideal leader in place? Because leadership is so critical. And I want to echo what he said. Leadership by example is the best way to make that change. Because if you have that workaholic leader, and let's say he or she's working around the clock and working all weekend, even if they save those emails and then sent them on Monday, that would make a difference. So leadership by example is key. But other things that can be done are very simple, and they really can change the tone, increase usage, and really remove that stigma. One is having a written policy in place. People like to be able to assess what their options are. Even if they're not working a flexible schedule today and don't want to tomorrow, maybe they want it in place in 2 years. It gives the people ability to plan and reduces tremendous amount of anxiety. It's also critical that if you want your professionals to be flexible and available for their work, they also have to be eligible for promotion. There has to be a give and take. They can't just be flexible and available but not eligible for promotion. They need to be assigned the good work. That's critical to have people in place that are monitoring assignments to ensure that these individuals who are working flexibly are getting the good assignments, getting the necessary exposure to individuals and people to advance, and also getting the good quality of work. They have to also be paid commensurate with their contribution. Compensation as a penalty is a very quick way to develop that stigma. So compensation is critical, and having a support system in place. Historically, people who were working flexibly, they had these secret arrangements and nobody knew about them. You have to have a community and you have to have support so people can benefit from each other's knowledge, and ideally having a point person in place who's responsible for overseeing these individuals working flexibly really helps with accountability. two other points that are critical to removing the stigma. One is training, and the other is technology. In terms of training, we train individual employees on every single thing, but we don't train them effectively on how to manage their time and how to be responsive and accessible when they're outside the office, how to prioritize and manage alternative scheduling. That's critical. The other critical point is technology. Technology is a gift, and it's also a punishment. And the question is, how can employers be more effective in giving guidelines to use technology responsively and be responsive and be accessible, but also be effective in delineating lines where appropriate between work and home? I can get more into the details of a written policy, but I don't want to take more of my time, and we can come back to that if you'd like.
I'd just like to share with you one recent example. When Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was nominated and not yet approved, and her name was floated around, ex-Secretary of State Powell was interviewed by Fareed Zakaria on CNN or whatever he runs his Sunday noon show on. And he asked him, you know, what is the one piece of advice you would give to Hillary Clinton should she succeed to become Secretary of State? And his answer was fantastic from my point of view. He said, you know, Fareed, you know that I am working all the time. I mean, he was commander-in-chief. I'm sure that's why he became commander-in-chief. But he said, the first thing that I did when I came to the Secretary of State, and mind you, this is a military man, said I installed 44,000 computers in the State Department globally. And then he says, my one piece of advice, he says, I'm not going to be in the giving Hillary advice business, but the one piece of advice that I will give her is that when she's not traveling, she should balance her life. And so Fareed said, you know, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, she should use the computer and not sit in the office and work all the time in meetings. She should balance her life, and that's what other people around her should do as well, because she'll be traveling enough of the time, and so will the others. And he says, and I found that I've done my best work. I've worked 24 hours, but I don't necessarily work sitting in the State Department. And this was his singular piece of advice to Hillary Clinton. So it's interesting to me that coming from a military man, and you will hear some other rather revealing information from, I think, Kali along these lines, that, you know, people from all walks of life who have embraced this issue and understood its benefits are advocating for it. And it's a story that is worth retelling because people won't question the credential or the character of General Powell, where they might yours as an advocate. So use it. The next question here is, to some extent it has been addressed, but if it hasn't, here's the opportunity. You know, how has work-life flexibility issue, how has it cut across different type of constituencies? What are the motivations of the different constituencies with respect to this issue?
But I don't like to get too narrow in categorizing groups because there is a lot of commonality as well. But I did mention that the next generation of employees, it's just how they work. If I like to say, if I can get everybody under the age of 30 in a soundproof room and ask them what they really think, they'd all say, why do I have to come to this building every day to do this work? They just don't think and operate that way. And that's one piece of it that I think is going to be a challenge to organizations. It's not that they're not being team players. This is just how they are. So it's helping them think about what they need, but then also the needs of the business. Going up the scale, you obviously have people who are becoming parents, and there's much research that says young fathers are more involved than perhaps their baby boomer compatriots were 20 years earlier. And then you get into elder care, which the numbers for elder care are quite overwhelming. Baby boomers and older level Gen Xers are dealing with elder care issues. And then retirement. Retirement is truly transforming before our eyes.
retirement is going to look very different. In fact, I almost think we aren't going to call it retirement in about 10 years. It's going to be something else because it just isn't going to look like what it's looked like in the past. So you have every single demographic on some level looking for the flexibility to manage all aspects of their life creatively. And it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays together.
Any other takers?
I would echo what Callie said. I think with older workers, I think retirement may not even exist if the economy keeps going down the tubes the way it is. But certainly older workers are going to need to work in the United States longer than they anticipated. They want to work longer because there's a lot of evidence that suggests that people are more psychologically healthy if they do work. There's also obviously in the U.S., again, the issue around health care expenses, and so older people in general, I think, are going to be part of the workforce, but clearly they've sent the signal through research that's been done that they are not interested in working, the way they worked when they were in their 30s and 40s. They're looking for more flexibility, more part-time work, more opportunities maybe to do seasonal employment, that kind of thing. So the older workers, for their own reasons, and in addition to what Callie said, the care of their spouses or their parents or whatever it might be are going to need flexibility to a very great degree. The other thing I would just say, which we sometimes may overlook because we think it's so obvious, is, you know, the demographics of couples have changed. Today, about 75% of couples are dual career couples. That is so radically different than what that statistic was 30 years ago. And 28% of the households in the United States are headed by a single parent. In both those situations, dual career couples and single parent head of households, there is just, as any of us know who have children or who have elderly relatives who are dependent on this, there's just nobody at home to take care of all the personal, family, domestic, and community needs that crop up. So in addition to the demographics around changing attitudes among younger workers or older workers, we also have the issue of, the changing nature of families and the fact that changing nature of the families really suggests that people are not just going to demand it, they're absolutely going to need flexibility in order to be able to get their personal and professional needs met.
And just from the point of view of our own organization, we're going to be moving 8,000 staff. And the statistic, which is reported on in paragraph 102, of the report of the improvement of the status of women clearly says, and it went to the General Assembly last year, that if 200 staff telecommute in this, which is less than 10%, there will be a $10 million savings. Mm-hmm. Now, from my point of view, who has no budget and no staff, I would say, well, give me a little bit of it, and I will be happy to hire somebody and actually increase the productivity that I give to the organization. I don't see why this money should be going to the utility company and this and all type of other services, which is what the expenditure amounts to. It's basically going to putting a desk somewhere and paying the rent on the space. So wouldn't it be more beneficial for the organization to perhaps share that cost with us? If they don't want to really save the money, then share it with us and let us hire people and let us do better things with it and let us produce more and be better professionals. So that's a radical view, but it's an alternative view. But the fact is that in our financial times, we're not going to be getting more money, I don't think, because government budgets are strained. And therefore, we will be forced to incur savings. And this is an opportunity over 5 years to incur savings. Only 200 staff commuting will incur $10 million savings. We can increase the telecommuting procedure to 2.5 days a week, which allows two people to share a desk, and get over all these hierarchical concerns of my desk can only be shared by my level rank and all this other stuff, which is completely outdated today. And it's outdated because money talks more than rank, I think, at the end of the day when there's a crunch. So there are things that the organization can easily do, and we're trying very hard to make them do it. And in the Capital Master Plan, we have an Assistant Secretary General named Mr. Michael Alderstein, who was particularly helpful. He gave us the figures. He understood the issue. And I think, it's been very good to have a champion who is outside to some extent, of the traditional areas that are doing this advocacy. But money talks. And I think that's going to be a very good driver. I mean, this is a bad time, but it's a good opportunity for the unconventional agendas. So that will bring me to the next question, which is a practical one, which is we have a huge wealth of experience here on this issue. So I'll ask all the panelists to respond by giving us some examples of what exactly is the face of flexibility. How is this happening over and above what we know, which is telecommuting, for example? Brad?
Yeah. I'll just quickly say, I mean, the most common forms of flexibility we find are flex time, which means being able to alter your stop and start times. I worked for Hewlett-Packard for 20 years, and every single employee dating back into the mid-70s was allowed to do that within the company, and, you know, the roof didn't cave in. Everything worked fine, but people were allowed to modify start and stop times each day. The second that you mentioned is telecommuting. IBM is one of our members. 40% of their 330,000 people do not report to an IBM office ever. They work virtually. They either work from home or they work from a client site or whatever, but they do not go into an IBM office on a regular basis. A third is compressed work weeks, where people work four 10-hour days in a week or over 9 days they cover enough hours so they get the 10th day off. We have Raytheon as a member. They use that very widely within their organization, and it's very well received. Fourth is job sharing, where two people who cannot work full-time take on a full-time job, share those responsibilities, and we've got lots of examples in the pharmaceutical industry where sales reps, two oftentimes women, share a sales territory and are able to do one full-time job, and two women share the position and oftentimes get better results than people who do not job share. Reduced hours is another one, where people are allowed to reduce their hours to 3 days a week or 4 days a week with a commensurate drop in pay. And I think part-time employees is one of the most underutilized and would be one of the most greatly appreciated benefits for working parents. Simply say to somebody, you can work 60% time for 60% pay, and you can still do interesting and challenging work. You're not marginalized as a result. Seasonal work is another thing. We work with CVS, a drugstore that allows people to work seasonally and includes allowing employees to move from the north to the south and work in their offices or in their distribution points. In different locations depending on where they want to live at a particular point in time. And then finally, I would just say flexible career paths. One of the most rigid industries, not to point to Barbara's industry, around career paths historically has been the accounting industry. And it's been, the mentality has been you either move up or you move out. That's the career path within the accounting industry. Well, today we see companies like Deloitte who are championing things called mass career customization, where they're saying we can create career paths that fit individuals. So those flex time, telecommuting, compressed work weeks, job sharing, seasonal work, flexible career paths are all some of those common things we see. And, of course, phased retirement, which somebody mentioned earlier, is also very popular.
Deborah.
Okay. Yeah. I wanted to pick up on that. I think it's a great outline of what really is out there.
When I think about the type of flexibility that's available, I really think about only two guiding principles. Number one is your own creativity and your employer's creativity, and number two is the business case. It's got to be a win-win situation, particularly in a market like this where finances are constrained. It has to be both in the employer's interest so that clients and colleagues and people you're working with are not negatively impacted, and it's in your interest. So just along those lines, I've run my business for 10 years. It's mostly lawyers who've emailed me and I've consulted to for 10 years on these issues. And of these thousands of emails, which I call the Dear Debbie emails, there are five areas that I hear over and over again that individuals want in terms of flexibility. So I think, and I'll just briefly touch on those five areas, what's important to think about is what are your flexibility needs and then how do you develop, one, a creative situation, and two, one that's a win-win. And those five areas will not be surprising to you. One is flexibility just in how you work. You can work long hours potentially, but you just want flexibility in how you work. Two is predictability and control, which many studies show is the largest reason for dissatisfaction when you don't have that predictability and control in your life. Three is reduced hours. Four is being off call, to be able to actually shut it off, shut off the BlackBerry, shut off the communication. And five is location, wanting to work in certain locations. So I'd encourage you, if you don't fit in one of those boxes that Brad mentioned, to think, what's a creative solution? What are my flexibility or work-life needs? And how do I design a win-win so that it's in my, you know, in the UN's interest, but it's also working for me and my family or whomever else is impacted?
That's really what I was going to add, and
point to Barbara's organization as an example. Sometimes they don't really fit into a need category. And that's one of the reasons why it's important to think of this not so much as a one-size-fits-all policy as much as a process. So the policies are important guidelines and give people the idea of what they could do. But around the margins of that, how does it apply to the job you do every day? How does it apply to what you need in your life? And to Debbie's point, come up with a plan. But sometimes I find in my work that people get boxed in by the policy and they don't think creatively. So let the policy guide you, but think of it more as a process that you think through what's going to work for both of you. The story that Aparna was mentioning is I gave a speech to the U.S. Navy. Believe it or not, the Navy is being very, really looking at flexibility, and their big driver is very much like yours, which is they feel it's important that the population in the Navy reflects the population they are protecting. And right now within the Navy, there's a very low percentage of women, particularly at the higher ranks. And so they're interested in flexibility, and I was presenting, and we were doing this big active workshop together, and an admiral stood up, and she was getting ready to take control of his ship. And she said, you know, just thinking this through and being creative about what we do on the ship and the different job capacities that we all have, I can already see different ways that we can all work. And not only can I run my ship better, but the people who work on my ship can have a better work-life fit. So they have policies that guide them, but she used it to begin a process of determining what would work in the different areas of her ship. And she even said, everything's not going to work in the same place, in the same way on the ship. But I see that different types of flexibility can work in different jobs. So that's what I've seen.
Anybody else? No. Flexible work methods that caught my attention, was actually on a website I read. And they were saying that they have peak moments of work. And we all know, especially in the United Nations, there are peak moments of work. For us, it has been these 2 weeks. For the General Assembly conference services people, it's most of the time, but certainly not in June, July, August maybe. So there are, in no matter which department and office of the United Nations you work for, there are peak times, and then sometimes you're seasonal work times. And the organization that I read about said that they had realized that there was a need for workers to work, you know, 50 to 70 hours during a crisis or during the peak period. So what they did is they said, over time, this is our peak time every year. Say it's a tax time. Or we've had a crisis in the Congo, for example. But other times when there's no peak time, we will cut down your work hours so that in the end you are averaging out your 40-hour week and you're not undermining or undercutting the organization. But the persons are better able to work their own work-life fit. And there's also less burnout. I mean, I find in the organization that we work for, under the rubric of you've taken an oath to work 24/7, which we all have and which we all do willingly, they do not recognize that there is such a phenomena called burnout or brownout. And that has serious effects. And it has serious effects because people are then taking leaves or are on sick leaves, and none of this is documented in connection to each other. But as Focal Point for Women, I hear about this all the time. I hear about men browning out and women burning out, and I don't see who this is benefiting. So that's one of the work methods that caught my eye, that if we did truly become flexible, we would allow not just for daily flexibility and weekly flexibility, but we would have a method that allows yearly flexibility, seasonal flexibility, which is very much part of our lives in the United Nations. So that's just one more. One of the outputs of this panel
because I hope it's not just a talk shop at the end of the day, it is a list of work-life arrangements that are out there. We won't list the organizations, but we will provide this list, and hopefully it will nudge the organization, and particularly reticent managers who are able to provide this, onwards to a paradigm where people don't want to work less, they just want to work better, and maybe they would be working more. It's 2:20, and I think that leaves us for some questions from the floor. So is that, if the panelists agree, then I open the floor for any questions you may have. Sir.
My name is Roger Pugh. I'm with Lawyers Without Borders. We do provide free lawyers throughout the world. My question is, how can we make the UN more flexible? It seems pretty rigid, open from 9 to 5 and not on weekends.
Well, am I the panelist? well, let me the tours do open on the weekends. The staff is actually, if you go to the Secretary General's floor, they're pretty much working around the clock. I mean, the organization suffers from a huge staffing problem, and I would not like to accept that statement, lock, stock, and barrel. I think the UN has to have more flexibility, but it doesn't mean that they're not working. They're working. In fact, they're overworking. And I think just about every dedicated and responsible staff member I know is most of the time overworked. So we have to introduce a method of flexibility within our work methods. But many people are working on the weekends. We may not be working and opening our doors to everybody, but people are working. So that's one way of answering the question. The other way is to say that the opportunities such as this are very targeted. This is part of our attempt to move this agenda forward. I mean, we are, as the Office of Focal Point, we are an advocacy unit. We are not linked to the Department of Management or to Human Resources, and we would like to move the organization in this direction, which is why over the last year under this Secretary General, we have at least succeeded in getting things out there which were never out there for 4 years. We have these terms of reference. We have strengthened the Focal Point Network. Now, getting all these things implemented is the problem, because we're up against attitudinal barriers, and we know that it's very difficult to change attitudes. What we are therefore trying is to trying to get the organization to enforce the behavior. We believe that if you enforce the behaviors, the attitudes will follow. I don't think we can undo what people's mothers and fathers have done. If they have got attitudes there that are ingrained in them, it's their parents or their sisters or whoever has to change it. We can't do that. But we can enforce behaviors that are encouraging of productivity and encouraging of what this organization stands for, which is humanism. I mean, why? This is part of that paradigm. So we thank you. I appreciate that. More. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, the UN has a built-in mechanism against burnout. You have the most generous leave system, holiday system in the world, with 6 weeks paid vacation every year. We are very envious to those who work with a lot less leave. But let's leave that aside. My question was for Barbara. You mentioned that in your research you had found that men and childless workers had more problems with work balance issues. Why? One would think that it would be mothers with children.
What our data showed was that when we ask people about their satisfaction with their work and their life, we got far lower numbers from our men and far lower numbers from people without children. We didn't dig behind that, but my sense is within our organization, it was because those people were less comfortable asking for some kind of alternative situation. It is far more customary for a working mother to feel comfortable stepping forward and say, I would like to work 3 days a week. I have two preschool children. But it's a lot less accepted for a father to make the same request. And for some reason, we've worked very hard to change this, and I think we've been successful in changing it. But I think also people thought that needs related to children were acceptable, whereas other needs perhaps not.
Could I just add one thing that I find remarkable? I would agree totally with what Barbara's guess about, you know, why that was the situation. But one of the things I find remarkable is most of our most progressive employers, and these, again, are really companies you'd know, almost all of them now do not ask what's the reason why you want flexibility. And I find that surprising because, you know, 10 or 15 years ago when I was in the corporate world, it would have been, well, for a mother with young children, that's acceptable and we will grant and approve some kind of flexible arrangement. Today that's shifted because men, single people, you know, all have their own reasons for wanting to do this. And almost every leading company we work with does not ask, why do you want the arrangement? All they want to know is how will this arrangement at least be neutral and hopefully beneficial to both you and the company, okay? So it's just kind of interesting how far that shifted, and the attitude of most of the leading companies is we don't really want to make a judgment about the validity of your request based on what you're going to do with your time. The only thing we want to judge is the validity of whether it will work for the work you need to get done. So
we have time for one more question. Gail.
I just want to follow up on what you just said, because I find it interesting that you say that you're at the stage now where no questions are asked, because our policy, for example, you have to make a case.
Yes.
And then your supervisor has to approve that before it goes any further. So because of, and don't forget this is a bureaucracy, so that because of that, a lot of people don't even want to start the process. And as one of the things I'm interested in is how do you move the attitude from even to get it to a point where women don't have to be embarrassed by the fact that they have children who have needs? You know, because much as you say on one hand that, you know, women didn't have a problem because children are acceptable, I'm not sure that this organization is even at the stage where children are acceptable.
Okay,
well, they are.
I didn't want to make the point that
they didn't have a problem. I'm just saying that organizations saw that as an acceptable reason to request a flexible work arrangement. So my point wasn't about acceptable. It was just that was just a given that that was a reason why many people would request a flexible work arrangement. The people I'm talking about still have to make a case for why flexible work arrangements can work for them. But what I'm saying is they don't have to say the reason I want flexible work arrangements is because I have an elderly parent who's sick, or I have a desire to run the Boston Marathon, or I want to go back to school part-time. The reason the companies are saying, we don't care what the reason is. What we care, the case that you need to make is that you can do your job satisfactorily with this new arrangement. And we're not here to judge whether or not you're running the Boston Marathon is more important than you're taking care of your elderly mom. That was my point.
Part of that is to take the bias out of the conversation, okay? Because
I back up Brad on this. I've been doing this work for 15 years, and I've seen that it evolve as Brad has, to where companies just realized managers brought their own bias to that conversation. And so why they make it reason neutral and about your job is it takes the bias out of the conversation. And what that does is it also removes the stigma from the mom, from the person with the care responsibility. And, you know, it was even harder for men who wanted to, in dual earner families, to go in and say, you know what, I just got to get home and get the nanny. You know, I mean, that was really hard. So it just removes that stigma and removes that bias from the conversation.
If I could just add to that, I think
that's right. I mean, I think the threshold
issue has to be, is this person talented? Is it somebody UN wants to retain and promote? That's the threshold issue. Assuming the answer is yes, then how can we do this work, as Brad said, so that, you know, not only satisfactory, but so that no one is negatively impacted by that individual's schedule? But one of the things that person has to think about is being an effective advocate, not just being talented, but showing your employer that this is in their interest to work with you on this arrangement, not accommodate. It's not about accommodation. This is about why is it in your interest? And part of those drivers is saying, yes, I'm talented, I'm doing great work. And a lot of times those people who don't get their flexibility met, those flexibility needs met, it's not that they'll just continue on and full steam ahead. They'll leave. And so the impact to the organization is greater than had they not just agreed to a different sort of arrangement. But that's an opportunity for the individual who's an advocate for themselves to demonstrate to the UN, okay, this is the value I'm bringing. This is how I'm going to do this so that nobody is negatively impacted by my schedule. This is the competition that's going on around these issues, whether it's among departments, that certain departments are looking better than others. This is the productivity that will result as with this new schedule. So bring in those pressure points so that it's understandable to your manager of why they need to make this work because it's in their interest.
I'll have to ask a question. I think we can stay here for about 10 more minutes. Now, is the audience willing to stay for 10 minutes, or are they going to get up and leave? Because if that's the case, we'll do the conclusion. Can you stay? Yes? No? Yes? Yeah. Okay. Question. Yes. Wait, this lady had her hand up for a long time.
Hi, I'd just like to say something. I've done 20 years in the UN, and till today I've never known the United Nations to be closed, not in any of their buildings, whether it's the Secretariat, DC1, DC2, or the Chrysler Building, in all four buildings which I have worked at some point of time. And talk about burnout and brownout. Yes, there are times, whether it's peak periods or not, that I've worked over 75 hours in the week and not got anything for it. What I do want to know at this point is, we do have a policy for flexibility. There is an STSGB out there. It has been out there for years and years. The problem is trying to get through to the program managers. The program managers who feel that you are only working when you're sitting at your desk. So long as they can see you in front or at your chair that you are working. If you're not there, you're not working. Is how do we convince our managers that we are better off not commuting 3.5-4 hours a day, that we can give all that time to the organization by doing our work, and they can check it as you're working on it. You're on email, you're on the internet, they've got your phone numbers. How do we convince them to give us at least one day a week that we need to work at home?
We converted our leadership by involving them in the process. And then also, it was not only a process of involving them, but at the same time, educating them about what this meant. And eventually, through all of that pre-work that we did, we spent a year and a half devising our strategy before we did anything to implement our strategy, through all of that pre-work, which enabled them to give input, but also educated them that by the time it came time to implement, they were comfortable with at least giving it a try. And what we found also, because it's a business strategy, that they also then became aware that by doing these things, by giving people some flexibility, you will have more productive people, and that will improve their performance. Whatever business unit they're responsible for managing, we gave them some tools that they can perform better. And because we are structured regionally and we have different leaders competing with each other to be the most successful, there was a sort of a sense that if you got on board with this earlier on, you were viewed as cutting edge and innovative, and therefore a better leader than your peer over here. And we found that very compelling as well.
I'd just like to add, and maybe I wasn't clear enough. You know, we had a mandate from the Secretary General's Policy Committee decision of last February, which was published on ISEEC, where he wants us to develop a scorecard where we actually monitor the use of these
arrangements, and there's a history behind it. What I was finding was that people were putting, I have been advocating for 5 years, literally, that you have to see how many people request it and how many people get it, because then you can show the gap. I know of divisions and departments where the power and control culture is so great. Instead of empowerment, it's about power, which is wrongly manifest. And that they were just, we can never give this. And there are men and women both in this boat. It's not just, you know, a gender issue. And we wanted to be able to show by numbers, making it far more objective, that there are places where there's a lot more being demanded and it's constantly being refused. We also want to show that there are divisions and departments where it's perfectly feasible if you look at their mandate, and yet the user rates are very low. So combine, this is in the scorecard. So the scorecard that the Secretary General has asked us to put out is now going to report on user rates by type of arrangement. Because before it was very easy, what departments were doing was saying, everybody has flexibility because 5% or, you know, 50% of my staff comes at 10 o'clock. But that now wasn't necessarily the work flexible work method that people really wanted in order to work better. And therefore, have instituted this. We've got it in General Assembly resolutions in the past when we had more activist committees from which the resolutions were coming out. We actually had specific language about work life. And what Kali says, it's about work-life fit. I mean, the balance issue is subjective. If you make it a work-life fit issue, well, everybody has to fit into something in life. I mean, you know, let's just universalize this thing. And if you agree with balance, good for you. You don't agree with balance, well, you fit. You got to fit your work into your life. Do you disagree with that? Mm-hmm. Well, no. So then you carry the conversation there. The other strategy that has worked with me is that sometimes managers, when you speak to them, say, well, you know, I need the output and I need this. They never say, I need the person because I need FaceTime and I'm a control freak. They will give 100 other reasons, some of which are legitimate, some of which are not. But what you can say to them is, well, would you work? If you are a responsible staff member, would you work? Say you couldn't come and the Secretary General demanded something of you, would you do it? And they would, of course, say, yes, of course, I would do it. And then you say, well, why do you think everybody else is different from you? And I think that if it's done gently and it's done kindly, it can be done. And it doesn't always yield results, but we have to work with the human character. And human character is very... everybody's different. I mean, you can't define it. So one recipe doesn't work. But these type of methods have worked. And one of the things that has worked, I know that people have picked up on this line, is that the person who's responsible will work anywhere, and the person who's irresponsible will work nowhere.
Yeah.
So it's not really about where you work. And nor are we the moral police, where we have to, you know, my job description doesn't say I'm a moral police.
Right, right.
So I don't have to make a judgment about whether you're going to sit and take care of your child or wash your pearls or do whatever you want to do. You know, you have to do your job and you do it as it best fits your life and your hobbies and your needs and your difficulties.
The lady from Malaysia has been trying to get
Hi, Aparna. This is Mirnaz from Human Security Unit.
Hi, Mirnaz.
I actually think that, you know, as a starting point, I mean, if it truly is to be a corporate culture of the UN, we really need to update the SG's bulletin. I mean, if you read the language of the 2003, it is non-committal, it is completely voluntary, it is at the discretion of heads of departments. Therefore, so I would say, first of all, if the SG is really, truly committed to a flexible arrangement, then this has to be updated, because this is a very non-committal piece of paper and it does leave for a lot of discretion. And I don't think that if you want to have change, you should actually have it so piecemeal that, you know, it becomes personal and then it becomes very uncomfortable for staff to sort of pursue that. The other thing that I would say is that I actually, as some of the panelists, and I think it was Kali, if I'm sorry if I said your name wrong, but Kali,
yes, that, you know, maybe the language should actually go outside of this work life that gives actually to some extent a little bit of a stigma. And it's not really in reality of the work that we do here and the changes that are happening. So why not instead, for example, much like the Capital Master Plan, talk about the cost-benefit sort of, you know, perspectives, talk about the technology and productivity, talk about the overcrowdedness of the offices and the fact that actually you are so many times interrupted in the office that it's absolutely impossible for you to be productive. Talk about the fact that the UN as a staff and as a body needs to be substantively cutting edge. And how are you supposed to be substantively cutting edge when you actually have no time to read anything? And you're supposed to come up with reports which you're going to guide people on, you know, the sort of lessons learned and best practices that are out there. So I think that if truly the organization as a whole is going to be a more effective organization, what one could frame that by necessity of the type of work that we do, by the type of, you know, organization that the UN is, the flexibility arrangement would need to be there to make the UN be a more effective UN. Not about work-life balance, as just a simple making the organization more effective. And I think the arguments could be made very, very sort of, you know, technically and without sort of, you know, personal whatever storylines. I mean, they could always be there, but much like the Capital Master Plan. I mean, that was very much based on cost-benefit analysis, based on the fact that, you know, we don't need offices for each level, that we can work in open space, that, you know, and all the rest of it. So, thanks.
Can I just say something? That's why I put that slide up there, because if you notice,
the work life is just one of six boxes. And believe me, I could have filled that with 17 boxes. Those are just a few of the things that flexibility could do for the various organizations that I've worked with and have done research on. So you're absolutely right. And that's why flexibility really is a business strategy. It is a business strategy, the way of an organization needs to operate in today's world. And so you bring up a really, you know, interesting point and a way to frame it so that it really does make it about how the organization operates.
And if you're not there yet internally to get the buy-in to write that new master plan
or whatever it ends up being called, two suggestions of what you can do to sort of build the case to get there. One is offer to do this as a pilot in one distinct area. You talk about what the needs of the organization are. Typically, when you're talking about working unconventionally, you want to make sure quality of work is still at the same level. You want to make sure that that individual who may be working in a different way is still responsive and accessible, and you want to make sure that person's flexible. So if there's an emergency, they change things around. You set up the pilot and say, we want to make sure those four criteria are still met, and let it happen in a small department or with a sampling of individuals who you know will handle the arrangement responsibly for 3 months and track your results. It's a really great way to have a proven internal example of this working and then say, okay, now we want to expand this into other departments or different areas. The other thing is to look around the UN and see where people are already doing it successfully and celebrate those people's successes. Interview them. See what's working for them, what isn't. Get their supervisor's support, ideally, so that you can internally create that competition once again and create that knowledge pool of how it can work successfully, let's say, in the Department of Management and in another department and that sort of thing. Those are two ways, a pilot and celebrating existing successes, that you can get there and get the support to write a plan like that and to have a multifaceted plan that's not just under that work-life stigma.
We're running out of time. And just to respond to you, Murnaz, we fully agree, I mean, as advocates. We couldn't agree more with what you're saying. The issue for us has been that of certain constraints. If we want to cost everything, the Capital Master Plan, where this issue originated recently, was because we met with them before they really started doing their business. And we said, why don't we use your opportunity? This is something that will save you money. We actually took the idea to them. They embraced it, and it hasn't been implemented yet, but I seem to think that it's taking root. The problem with costing of other things and making it, we are trying our best through this panel and through the use of everybody else to change the
the arguments and to change the vocabulary with which this issue is presented. But it does require, for example, costing. Now, the United Nations has been struggling with the issue of costing just about anything for a long time, and it's the same thing with productivity. So it's very difficult for us to use indicators that become really quantitative, which I know if they were made quantitative would be highly effective. But we haven't been able, we don't have the resources to do the type of, so we have been had to do things like surveys, and we'll do more surveys, and we're putting it out in the Secretary General's report in terms of usage rates. So we have really been forced, because of budgetary constraints and staffing constraints, pigeonholed into using indicators that are very easy to implement and report on. The Secretary General has said that we have to report on this issue every 6 months. And I think the driver for him is very much this leading by example, that we have to model, you know, whatever it is that we advocate. So, you know, it's very difficult to disagree with you. On the policy, we are aware of it, and it will be the next step. But we want to ride the wave of at least increasing implementation rates now, given that we have a policy. We will also then look to simplifying procedures. The procedures are too complicated. You need two signatures for one day of work. I mean, it's really, it's not effective. It makes people uncomfortable. So on this note, I think it's 2:45. People have been generous staying over. I would like to thank the panelists and just provide the two concluding sentences or three for this. One is what I hear is that rigidity has to be eliminated. There is no room for rigidity, I think, in the modern, in any sense. When the body becomes rigid, it becomes problematic. And I think that is true when the workforce becomes rigid and when our mindset becomes rigid. So rigidity, perhaps, is our greatest cultural barrier in many ways, and we have to overcome it organizationally. We have to assist others to overcome it, and we have to model that flexibility ourselves. We all have a sphere of influence, all of us, irrespective of title, rank, and position. So that we have to exercise that. The other important message is that the arguments, all of the arguments, whatever they are, on the issue of work-life fit cannot be looked upon as a perk. This is not a perk. This is a regular work method. It is a method that we want to work better and to work more. It is not a method that we want to instigate to work less or to work more leisurely. We want to work better and we want to work more. And this is one means which the organization has to allow us to work better and to work more. And finally, I'd just like to end with something I know. There is a CEO of Pepsi called Indra Yuni, and she happens to be Indian, so I'm very pleased to be able to quote her. But she was asked in a conference, you know, what is it that has assisted you? Why have you, you know, to what do you attribute this success? And she said something very poignant and applicable. She said, I have been lucky enough to always be, or to most of the time, be surrounded by people who have allowed me to be who I was. And that allowed me to conserve my energies and not spend it resisting what I didn't otherwise want to resist. So I channeled my energies into the productive as opposed to into the resentment that is generated when your supervisor doesn't give you the day off because it's a storm day. This happened last week. I had three people come to me and say, I had to take a vacation day because I wanted to work, but I had 8 inches in my driveway, and they wouldn't give me the day off to telecommute from because there was a rule that was saying that you had to do it in advance. There are other cases where somebody's mother fell sick. She wanted 1 hour to take her to the doctor and monitor the mother, and that's it, and wanted to work. And she was told, no, the rule says it has to be approved in anticipation. And the response is, you know what, I'm going to shut the computer, I'm going to turn off the telephone, and I'm going to sit and read my book. I'm just not going to work. Because, you know, there's a resentment that is generated with this. And I think the organizations and the human beings have to realize what Indra Yuni is saying. She's saying that I was lucky enough that nobody made me spend my energies fighting these type of natural human emotions that otherwise you spend your energies on. So that's, I think, that's a very, you know, how you spend your energies, conserve your energies, conserve them for the organization. I think this is a message that the organization can also embrace and isn't. It's philosophical, but so what? So is humanism. So is the foundation on which this organization is built. It's built on justice. So let us take those thoughts and please be advocates for this issue. I so very much appreciate that you're here because we are fully aware of how many competing events have occurred at the same time today. And thank you. We send you our affection. We send you our gratitude. And we look forward to working with you in any possible way that we can to facilitate your life and the life of the United Nations. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, all of you.